Now we're holding on page Chof Aleph in Psachim, middle of, about the, a little bit above the middle of the page, by the two dots, middle of Os Mem Hei. We started talking about various astronomical details about the sun's path through the sky and the sun and how long that path is and how long, how much distance can a person travel in that amount of time. We mentioned in that connection what Rava says, that Shita Alpha Parsi Hava Alma, the world is 6,000 Parsa, which Rashi said that doesn't refer to the size of the actual globe, but rather it refers to the distance that the sun traverses from sunrise to sunset. Although, like we talked about yesterday, the Maharal brings in Be'er HaGoyla that it may not be that Rava is talking in a physical sense, but rather that he's talking in a metaphysical sense. Anyway, the Gemara has been bringing several proofs against Rava to show that on the face of it, the earth is, or the sun's path across the earth, whatever, is much larger than 6,000 parsa. So here's another proof, the Gemara says. And why does it have to bring so many proofs against him? And once we slugged him up once, that should be that. First of all, it could be in different yeshivas. They were discussing this, and in each place they came up with a different proof against him. And then when Ravina and Ravashi assembled the Gemara from what was learned in all the various yeshivas, so they put it all together one after the other. The other possibility is sometimes the Gemara will say, you might find a way to reconcile. You might find an answer to one of the previous ones. So we're going to bring another one to say, even if you can answer that previous one, but you still slugged up from this one. The fact is, by the way, we have to realize that this, a lot of the things we're saying over here are, at least on the surface, are simple facts that anybody should realize. And Rabbi Elzebo was mentioning to me yesterday that, here we're not, after all, talking a matter of halacha. This that we said that Rava had learned from his Rebbeim, Shita Alpha Parasi Hava Alma, it's not a matter of halacha. So if we contradict him on it and we show that it's contradicted by various things, it's not as big a deal, really. Anyway, so the Gemara says, Toshma de Omer of Yechanan Zakai. What answer did a Basko give that Rosha, namely Nebuchadnezzar, the Shasha Omar, when he said, and there's a posset quotes in a saying, Ela al Bamose of, I will go up to the heights of the clouds, Edamela Elyon, I will make myself like the Most High. Now, in a positive sense, Adam Elyon, we have all over the place in Chassidus, we're talking earlier Sforim as well, where it talks about that Odom is Meloshon Adam Elyon, because a person is expected to a certain extent to resemble Hashem. But Nebuchadnezzar thought in his grubber way that he means, in other words, I'm going to ascend as high as possible and be on an equal level with Hashem. So what Baskol came at? What did the Baskol come and tell him? So Yotza Baskol v'Amrilo, Rosha ben Rosha, you Rosha the son of a Rosha, ben Bnoi shall Nimrod a Rosha, the descendant of Nimrod, not Baskol, ben Bnoi literally means the son of, he's 1500 years after Nimrod, so we don't mean literally ben Bnoi, but we mean the descendant of Nimrod a Rosha, Shehimrod, and Nimrod was called that, Shehimrod is called Olam Kulai Olai Malchusei. In his kingship, he made the entire world rebel against me because he spearheaded the construction of the Tower of Babel, where one of the purposes of it was to rebel against Hashem. There's different gusois over here, whether the word is that himrid olai, that he made them rebel against me, or himrid olav, which would literally mean against him, in which case it's a nice euphemistic way of saying that they rebelled against Hashem. Whatever. Tosfos actually points out, this Gemara is also in Chagiga, Tosfos points out over there, it doesn't even necessarily mean that Nebuchadnezzar is an actual descendant of Nimrod, because Nimrod, we know, was a son of Chum, a grandson of Chum, Bechush Yolodus Nimrod. Nebuchadnezzar was from the people of the Kaskim, who are descended from Arpachshad, or from Kesed, two possibilities, who are descendants of Shem. So it doesn't even necessarily mean that he's literally a descendant of Nimrod. He's called that because he was like Nimrod in the sense they both were Moshe Bekippa, they both had their power base in Babel. They both fought against the Jews, and therefore, in that sense, the Baskel is saying, you're similar to Nimrod. Anyway, let me tell you something the Baskel says. You think you can actually get all the way up to the heights of heavens and be on an equal level in Hashem. How long does the average person live? 70 years. Then big Buddha's 80 shana. And if a person has extra vitality, extra strength, then they lose 80 years. You mentioned the same about having 70 shana, then big Buddha's 80 shana. Now, mind you, the Gemara elsewhere says that Nebuchadnezzar himself lived longer than that. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that says that Nebuchadnezzar was one of the only survivors of Sancheirev's army, and Sancheirev came and attempted to conquer Yerushalayim well over 100 years before the Churban. So if Nebuchadnezzar was already a soldier in Sancheirev's army at that time, and then he lived long enough to destroy the Beis Hamikdash and still to live and then to live for another 20 odd years past that, then he lived a lot more than 70 or 80. But the point is, fine, look, even if he lives to be 150, 200, still nothing by comparison to all the figures we're going to give over here. Anyway, so the Baskel continues, consider, just to get from Earth to the Rakia, to the first level of space, is a 500 years walk. If you were to walk it, it would take you 500 years to get there. The thickness of the Rakia itself is another 500 years journey. And between each level of the Rakia and the next is another 500 years journey. And between each one, and the Gemara goes on in Chagiga and says even more. So already from that, until you even reach above the seven Rakiyim, which it says over there in the Gemara in Chagiga, they have seven Rakiyim. By the time you're reaching that, you already have 15 times 500, one times 500 to reach the first Rakiya, and then you have this, the thickness of the seven Rakiyim and the space between one and the next. And then the Gemara goes on to say, then you have the feet of the highest Raglei Achayim. Connected kulam, that's equal to everything that was below it, which I'll be Kabbalah is the idea that we know Malchus of one level is Attic of the next level, so it incorporates all of it, and the Karsulei Achayis connected kulam, and so on and so forth, and you finally reach up to the Kitzei HaKavod. So here the Gemara is not even getting into that level of detail. Just to reach above the seven Rakiyim is already more than a person would be able to in several lifetimes. So therefore, the Baskel finishes off with another pasuk from that section in Yeshaya where he's saying El al bamasei av, and Hashem responds to him, no, achal sheol turad, you will be brought down to the sheol, which is Gehenim, el yarkasei bur, to the deepest of the pits, to the uttermost depths of the pit. So fakef, you're not going to be high as you wanted, you're going to be the lowest of the low. The point is, again, we see from this, that the world alone is a 500 years journey. So that's a lot more than Rava's 6,000 parasa. Because the Gemara is assuming over here that elsewhere the Gemara talks about that the distance across the earth is the same as from the earth to the Rakia. So if it's 500 years journey from the earth to the Rakia, then it's also 500 years across the earth, and that would be a lot more than Rava's 6,000 parsa. So again, Tiyuvta, that's a contradiction to Rava's 6,000 parsa. Okay. Having talked about this whole business of the sun's path through the sky and the size of the earth and the size of space and so forth, so the Gemara brings some more discussion on related topics. Tanan Abaron, we learn in a Braisa, Chachmi Yisrael Oimnim Galgal Kavua Umazolis Chozrim. The Jewish Chachamim say that the Galgal is fixed and the Mazolis move. Now there's many, many, many different explanations what this means. So first let's learn the Chachmi Umas Ha'olam say in the Gemara, and then we'll talk about some of the explanations. The Goyish HaChachamim say just the opposite. The Galgal moves, the Galgal rotates, and the Mazolis are fixed. Now, Rashi explains like this. You have the 12 Mazolis. You have the 12 signs of the zodiac that the sun passes through every year in its annual cycle. And in Nisan time, the sun rises in Mazel Tver, then gradually the sun shifts through that mazel, and by the time you come to Iyar, it's rising in mazel shur, and so on and so on. The Chachma Yisrael are explaining that when we say galgal kavuo mazolis chozrim, means there's a galgal, there's like a wheel or a sphere that the mazolis are attached to, that doesn't move. What does move is the mazolis move a little bit. So they don't make a full circuit. Each one moves a little bit. The amount it takes, essentially, Rashi says, to bring the sun to the next mazel. So like they shift a few degrees, and then they shift a few degrees in one direction or the other. But basically, they stay in place. Whereas the Chachmei Umas HaOlam are saying that the galgal is chozer, this complete galgal revolves around the earth, And then the mazalis would be kavuyim, would be fixed to it. So that's how Rashi explains. There's many, many other explanations of what these two possibilities are. Among them are the Maharal talks about, again, in the Sefer Be'er HaGadol that we were talking about yesterday, that what it means is basically the Chachmei Yisrael and Chachmei Umas Olam are arguing what is the one that provides the motion and what kind of just goes along for the ride. The Chachmei Yisrael say that the Mazolos are the ones that actually move. And the Galgalt, because it's attached to them, therefore it automatically goes along with them. Whereas the Chachmei and Mazolim are arguing the other way around. The Galgal is the main motive force, and the Mazolis are just kind of along for the ride. Then there's different other possibilities. One of them being that when the Chachmei Yisrael say Galgal Kavua, they mean the Earth's atmosphere, and Mazolis Chozrin would mean that the planets and the stars revolve in space, and they're not actually attached to anything. They circle around the earth, but they're not actually attached to anything. Whereas the Chachmei Umas Olam would say that they're actually attached to a galgal, which that itself moves. That's Chozer, and the Mazolos are attached to it and go along. So it's interesting. The Maharal had a Talmud named Rav David Ganz. This Talmud, this Rav David, was besides that he was well versed in Torah, having learned from the Maharal, he was also Lahavdil well versed in the Chochmas Umas Olam of his time. In fact, he wrote a sefer on Jewish history, a well-regarded sefer on Jewish history called Semach David, and he mentions in there a lot of things. He has a whole section in there on Goyishe history as it affects Jewish history as well, which he got from books on Goyishe history that were available in his times. Anyway, he was also friendly with a couple of the Goyishe scientists of his times, Tycho Brahe and then Johann Kepler, who between the two of them, they made new discoveries as far as the motions of the planets. And in particular, Kepler figured out that the planets move in ellipses rather than up until that point it was assumed they move in circles. And then he figured out the laws of planetary motion and whatever. Anyway, they once told him, if we understand this Mazolis, this Galgal Kavua, Mazolis Chozrim, and the opposite, the way that we just said, that it means the Chachmei Yisrael are saying that the Mazolis are not attached to anything, whereas the Chachmei Umas Olam argue they're attached to Galgalim, then they say, in that case, it comes out, they said to Reb David, you're Chachamim, then we're right. Because we found in our researches that, in fact, the planets are not attached to any Galgalim. They just move in the space. They just move in space based on gravity.
They're not attached, but they're in a predictable.
They're in a predictable orbit, sure. Right. So they're saying, in other words, when we have over here this Galgal Chozer Mazolis Kvurim, which one way of understanding that is to say that the Mazolis are fixed, are attached to a Galgal, which moves around the earth and carries them along with it. So these two scientists told Rav David that it comes out that your Jewish Chachamim were more correct about that because there are in fact no such Galgalim. Early 1600s, yeah. Late 15, early 1600s, yes. Omar Rebbe, Tshuva L'Divreihem. Rebbe says, you know, we have a refutation of what they say. They're claiming Galgal Chozer Mazolis Kvurim, which means, according to them, the Galgal makes a complete circuit around the earth. In that case, then you should have any one of the Mazolis can be visible in the sky at different times, or in different parts of the sky, that is. And yet, Me'olam L'Matzinu Egla B'Dorim Ba'Akrav B'Tzofen. And yet, we never find Egla on the south or Akrav in the north. So we talked about yesterday, Egla and Akrav may be, Rashi translates them as Mazel Shur and Mazel Akrav, respectively, which are the Mazolis of, in which the sun rises in Iyar and Cheshvan, respectively. Tosfos argues with that, because in fact we do have other Gemaras that imply that those Mazolis do circle around the sky, and you do see them in different parts of the sky at different times of the year. Rather, Tosfos says that Egla and Akrav are evidently other constellations or other individual stars. So we talked about yesterday, Egla might actually be Agola, the Big Dipper or the Little Dipper, which those are always in the north. You never see them in the south. And Akrav then would be some other star that's always in the south and never in the north. So Rebbe says, if the Chachmei Umas Ha'olam were right about Galgal Chozer, implying that it revolves around the earth, a complete rotation, then you should sometimes find that Egla and Akrav would switch positions, and you always see them in the same relative positions in the sky, showing that the Chachmei Yisrael must be correct. However, The Maharal, following his way of explaining in Be'er HaGoyla, he says the point of what Rebbe is saying is, if the Chachmei Umas HaOlam are saying that the Galgalus Chozer, why would we have to assume that it moves only in one plane? It's a sphere. It could move in any way. There's like a ball can rotate in any direction. So why would it have to go from east to west, let's say, or from west to east? Why couldn't it sometimes turn from north to south, and then you'd see Eglah and Akrav switch positions? Therefore, it must be that, like the Chachmei Yisrael say, that Galgal Kavua, the Galgal is fixed in place, and therefore it can't move, and therefore these mazolis remain in their respective positions. However, Maskif Rav Acha by according to Einstein, right. Well, he's talking about something else. By Einstein's time, they don't have Galgal in them. Well, that's what we're saying. Already in Kepler's times, 300 years before Einstein, scientists already decided there's no Galgal in them. The planets and whatnot, are the planets and the stars and everything just move in space, on their own, basically, by gravity or whatever. Now what we're talking about is when we're saying that there's a Galgal, and the Chachmei Umas HaOlam are claiming that everything is attached to one or more respective Galgalim, and those Galgalim rotate around the Earth, well, then why would you have that any group of stars could be seen in different parts of the sky at different times? And it was, again, to take the Maharal's way of looking at it, why would it have to rotate like this? Why can't it just sometimes rotate like that instead? And then you would have things are going to switch positions from north to south.
That's the nature of the
principle. That's the question. That's the thing. Maskif Rav Acha bar Yaakov. So Rav Acha bar Yaakov asks on Rebbe's challenge, not necessarily the Dilma Kibbutzina Derechaya. Maybe it spins like the way, like the axis of a millstone. Butzina, Rashi says, is the metal pin on which millstones turn. So you have a pair of millstones, you have a pair of round stones where one of them moves above the other one to grind the wheat between them. And you have kind of a pin, or you have like a central piece, a central axle that they turn around so that they can turn only in one direction. Or similarly, you could compare it to the hinge of a door. Doors in those days, the hinges weren't fixed to the sides like we have our doors nowadays. Rather, they were fixed to the top and bottom. You'd have a pin sticking out of the top of the door, which would go into a hole in the lintel, and you'd have a pin sticking out the bottom that would go into a hole in the ground. You look at your kid's Lego set, you'll find the doors there are constructed on a similar principle. Anyway, therefore, sort of Achav Yaakov is pointing out, really, in other words, what you could have is essentially there could be two wheels turning one inside the other, where one of them is turning more relative to the other one, but it's still fixed. It's still more fixed relative to the middle of it, to the central axis of it. So therefore, in other words, it's quite possible, even according to the Chachmei Umas HaOlam, that the Galgal is Chozer, you could have that it moves, but not to the extent where you're going to have Eglav Atzofen, that we're going to have Eglav Adorim Ba'akav Atzofen, like Rebbe is saying, because you're assuming that they're saying there's only one Galgal. In fact, there could be multiple Galgalim. Or the Maharal understands that he says, what Rav Acha bar Yaakov is saying is you're assuming that it's like a ball that can turn in any which direction. Maybe not. One axis of movement is fixed. Alderach, like you have the axis of the earth when it spins on its axis. So therefore, it could conceivably go west to east or east to west, but it can't go north to south because you have that axis that fixes it in place. So therefore, Rav Acha bar Yaakov is saying, in other words, that Rebbe's proof against the Chachmei Umas HaOlam is really not such a strong one. So we can still say that Chachmei Yisrael are correct, but we don't have that knockout punch against them like Rebbe thought. Okay, the Gemara continues. Chachmei Yisrael Omrim, but Bechlal, by the way, also, we'll talk about that soon. Never mind. Chachmei Yisrael Omrim, now we have another machlokes of the Chachmei Yisrael and the Chachmei Umas HaOlam. By the Chachmei Yisrael say, by Yom Chama Mahalachas, Lamata Min HaRakia. During the daytime, the sun travels below the Rakia. We talked about yesterday, in other words, the Gemara's conception of it is that the Rakia is like a dome over the earth. Whether you say, and some Mephoshim understand that the Gemara would be talking about as if the earth was flat, and other Mephoshim, the Maharal, among others, talk about that it still was on the assumption that the earth is spherical. Whatever it is, the heavens are like a dome over it. So now what you have is, How does the sun move above the earth? You have, it comes, we talked about yesterday, that it comes from outside the Rakia, or it comes from someplace else beyond the Rakia. It passes through the Rakia, we called it yesterday in the Gemara, Oivia Rakia, the thickness of it, and then it comes in, like, so to speak, through an entrance over there, through an opening, which we say in davening, Ubekeah Halone Rakia. And then it moves from east to west throughout the day. So during the daytime, it's below the Rakia, and therefore we get its light and its heat. By night, the Chachmei Yisrael say it goes above the Rakia, and therefore it's outside of our view. The Chachmei Yisrael, I mean, by Yom Chamam Alach, it's the Milam in the Rakia, over Laila Lamata min Harakia. Or in the Gemara, actually, you have a Girsa instead of Harakia, a Karka. So the Chachmei Yisrael say, by day, the sun is traveling above the Rakia, and shining through it to us. And by night it's below the character, it goes underground. And that's why we don't see it.
So
the Rambam holds that the earth is in the center and the sun goes around it. He's not taking a view specifically on where the sun goes at night. Bepashtus, yes, the sun is circling around the earth, and it means at some point it's traveling to a place outside of our horizon. That can be described as under the earth in the sense that you'd have to so to speak tunnel through the earth in order for us to see the sun. Omar Rebbe, the Nirin Divrehen Midivrein. So Rebbe says it seems more reasonable to accept their words of the Chachmei Masoilam more than ours. Shabayoy Ma Yonis Sonin of Alila Roiskin. Because we see that by daytime, springs of water that come from the ground, the water is cold. Why? Because the sun is so far overhead, it's not really warming them up. Because they come from underground, so they're not warmed up significantly by the sun. Over Lila Royskin, but at night you see that they're hotter and steam comes off them, so therefore it's more logical to say, like the Chachmei Masoilam, that by night the sun is closer to them being under the ground, and therefore it warms them up. Again, there's many different explanations of exactly what this means, how we understand this in terms of how we understand nowadays the motion of things. But one thing is, first of all, the Maharal gives an explanation that, let's talk about a few things. First of all, the Maharal says that when we're talking about a Rakia, before we were talking about Galgal, so the Maharal understands Galgal is talking about an actual physical thing. Now, though, when we're talking about Rakia, we're not talking about an actual physical thing. We're talking about what effect does the sun have on the earth in terms of warming it and providing light and heat and energy and whatever else. So the argument is that when we're talking about the Rakia, we're talking about a metaphysical thing that separates the sun from us, or that doesn't. So you can talk about it. In other words, during the daytime, there's no rakia in the way because the sun is directly shining down on us and warming us. Whereas by night, you can talk about that there's that metaphorical rakia that keeps the sun away from us. So there's that. There's also a number of mafoshim that explain that when Rebbe is saying nirin divrein midivreinu, now some mafoshim do understand that it means that literally Rebbe is saying we have no choice, we have to concede to the opinion of Omas Olam. In fact, Maushab brings over here from a Gemara in Baba Basra, where it seems from a Gemara over there that Rebbe Yeshua agreed with the Chachmei Omas Olam in that. On the other hand, and Rabbi Avraham ben Arambam brings from that this is an example of how the Chachamim are always seeking the truth. They're not embarrassed to say we Chachamim were wrong and Chachamim Masoilim were right. On the other hand, there are a number of Mephoshim that learn that Rebbe does not mean that we do reject what the Chachmei Yisrael say and accept instead what the Chachmei Masoilim is saying. He's saying it's more logical to accept what they're saying. Nevertheless, we have the Kabbalah that it's not so. And in fact, again, in davening, we use the expression of Rakeah Haloi Nerakia, implying that there are, so to speak, windows in the heaven that the sun comes through and shines to us, where according to the Chachmei Masoilim, there'd be no such thing because the sun just travels around the curvature of the earth and shines on the other side by night. So Rebbe, it's not a pasuk, it's a line, and it's a line in davening. So Rebbe, right, so it's not a pasuk, but in any case, Rebbe would say, nirin divrein midivreinu, means when you consider the physical manifestation that we see as far as the mayonis, how they are by day versus by night, it seems more logical to accept what they say. But nevertheless, Rebbe would be saying, the fact is, we have the Kabbalah from the Anshek Nes Sagdola, who composed that line in davening, that it's not in fact so. And again, there are other different explanations of deeper meanings behind this discussion of where the sun is by day and by night that again allow us to say, and a number of Achronim talk about this, that again, what it may mean is that we're saying on a superficial level that what they're saying is correct, but nevertheless, when the Chachamim are saying that by day the sun is l'mata min arkiya, or v'layla l'mayla min arkiya, there are deeper meanings to it, alpi Kabbalah and alpi other aspects of Torah that make it that after all, what the Chachamim are saying is ultimately the really correct thing. This though that we're talking about over here about the springs being cooler by day and warmer by night, this has an implication la halacha, because you have the whole thing about mayim shalonu for matzahs for Pesach. So earlier in the Masechta, the Gemara talks about this business of mayim shalonu, and Rashi explains over there that what it is you always, after you draw the water, you have to leave it for 12 hours to cool off. On the other hand, now there are Rishonim who learn, based on this Gemara over here, that it doesn't necessarily mean is. All it means is you have to draw it by day, because by day, as we're saying over here, the springs are cooler. You can't draw it by night, because then it'll be warmer, and then you have the problem that it'll make the matzahs chametz faster. So in practice, in Shulchan Aruch, we're choshesh for both days, and because of that, you have to draw it, so you draw it like right before Shtia, and you leave it overnight, and that way you're accommodating both days. But so this Gemara actually comes up in a matter of halacha. Anyway, the Gemara continues.
So people are saying in Europe, it's cold, or in America, climate change.
Right. Yeah, but nevertheless, even if you were still saying that, by night the springs are hotter in any given place than they are by day. Is it the kind of heat that we're talking about that if you were to measure it with a thermometer, you'd notice a difference? I don't know. I mean, look, you know, the fact of the matter is, v'halacha, you still can't, you can't take water out of your fridge at 32 degrees and use it for baking matzahs either. You still have the dinim of mayim shalonu. How we do things in halacha is not always something that's measurable with scientific instruments such as thermometers, but you do have this point over here that by night we see steam coming off them, and they're evidently warmer. If nothing else, they're warmer than the air around them, which is why steam rises off them, and therefore that's reason enough to not use them for matzahs until they cool down. Okay. Tanya Rav Nosson, I mean, now we learn in a Braisa, Rav Nosson says a similar point. During the summertime, the sun travels high up in the sky, and therefore it beats down on us more directly, not on an angle. Therefore, the whole world is hot because the sun beats down on us. But the springs stay cool because they're underground and they're not so affected by the sun's rays. During the winter time, the sun is traveling lower in the sky, closer to the earth. In other words, like the rays of it are hitting the earth on an angle such that the atmosphere is cold. Therefore, because the sun's rays don't warm it so much, but the springs are hot. Because again, because the sun's rays are striking the earth at an angle which actually penetrates more into the earth and has more of an effect on them. And again, this is also negei l'halacha, because Nissan being the tail end of Yimos HaGashamim, then you have this consideration also factors into when we talk about when to draw the water from Mayim Shalanu, is you want to draw it at a time when that heat that it got from the sun is at its minimum. Okay, Tanan Rabbanan, then we learn in a Braisa. Another thing about the sun's movement, bar bosh vilin chama mahalachas. The sun goes in four different paths. Nisan Iyar Sivan mahalachas baharim. During the months of Nisan Iyar and Sivan, it travels in the mountains. Now, the Maharal also points out in Be'er HaGoyla, again, he wrote this whole sefer against a yid of his times, or a yid of Chaman Chacham, who had written a sefer arguing that the Chacham really didn't understand natural science, and the Maharal is out to disprove that. So he points out, of course, the Chacham knew the sun doesn't travel specifically in the mountains in Nisan Iyar and Sivan, and specifically in the valleys in another season or whatever. It means rather the sun's effect is more noticeable in the mountains during this season and during the valleys in that season and so on and so forth. So in the mountains, Kedilafasha is a shlogim, and there the effect it has is it melts the snows that are on the mountains. Tamuz of the Elam Halachas v'Yishuv. During the next 3 months of the summertime, the sun travels in, or in other words, mainly has its effect on the settled areas of the world, Kedilavasha is a Paris, in order to ripen the fruit. Tishrei Cheshvan Kislev Ma'aleches B'yamim, during the next 3 months of the fall, the sun's effect is mainly on the oceans, the Yabashes Anahoris, in order to dry up the rivers, because you have areas where you need water during the summer, but now during the winter, especially in Eretz Yisrael and Bavel and other places like that with a climate like that, you don't need the rivers so much during the winter time because you have rainfall. So therefore, so it dries up the rivers. So they, in other words, maybe not dries them up completely, but in other words, so they go back to their normal size. They're not swollen with melt water from snow and whatnot. And that way people can swim in them more easily. People can cross them more easily, etc. Tavis, Shvat Ba'adar, and then during the winter, Ma'alachas Ba'midbar, the sun mainly travels through and has an effect in the desert, Shalav Yabesh HaZroim, in order not to dry up the seeds that have been planted in the ground during the fall and are currently growing and germinating in the ground. You don't want them to dry up and not be able to produce and not be able to produce a crop. Marsha points out, so you have two different factors. You can talk about heat versus cold, and moisture versus dryness. The four seasons that we're talking about over here, each one reflects a different combination of those two factors. So Nisan Iyar Sivan, the springtime, is Cham V'lach, it's hot and moist. So therefore we're saying that's the time when the snow melts. Kufas Tamuz, the summertime, is Cham V'yavish, it's hot and dry. So that's the time when the fruit ripens and so forth. But the other ones, the winter is Kair V'yavish, and then, not the winter, the fall is Kair V'yavish, and then the winter is Kair V'lach. So each one of them has the effect that we're saying over here in the Gemara. So Hashem, in other words, Hashem moderates these respective things and combines them together appropriately for what's needed for that respective season. That's humidity is included in Lach. Yes, you're thinking of New York climate where it's humid during the summer. You have to be considering the climate we're talking about primarily of Eretz Yisrael, Bavel, other places like that have a Mediterranean climate. Go to Southern California as another example of a place in the world that has that kind of climate. You don't have no humidity during the summer. Yeah, it's just hot and dry. It's a dry heat, Yeah, so that's exactly what Marisha is saying over here. Cham v'yavish. Yeah. Okay. Arabic Pesach in Perek Asiri. So the subject of this parak starts talking. It talks all about the Seder. So we had four prokim of the Masechta that talk about Pesach as we celebrate it nowadays. Then we had the next five prokim talk about various details of the Korban Pesach. And now the tenth parak gets back to Pesach as we do it nowadays, the actual dinim of the Seder. In fact, in the times of the Rishonim, the Me'iri writes, they used to divide Masechta Pesachim into two separate Masechtas, which they learned separately. He says that's why the Masechta is called Pesachim in plural. They would learn the first four and the tenth parak as one unit, and then they'd learn the other ones, the other parakim, as a separate unit as part of, if they're learning Seder Kodshim, then they'd learn that. You find actually a vestige of that in our printed Gemaras nowadays. You look at the end of the fourth parak, the parak ends in the middle of the Amud, and then at the body, have the whole Amud, the whole rest of the Amud is filled up over there with a description of bringing the Seder, the Korban Pesach. And similarly, at the end of the ninth parak, you also have only a small amount of Gemara, and the whole rest of it is filled up with the dinim of Pesach chain. Why? Because when they first printed the first full edition of the Gemara in the early 1500s, they still kept that division. So they didn't want to begin a new Masechta on the same page as the previous one. So they left the rest of the page blank and started the next one on the next onward. Eventually, someone came, a Talmud Chacham, from a couple of generations later and filled up that space with descriptions of Pesach Rishon and Pesach Sheni. So the main topic of the parak is all about the Seder. And so it starts by talking about, you have Dalad Kosis, and the first one of them is for Kiddush. So that leads the Gemara into a long discussion about the dinim of Kiddush and Havdalah. This is the main place in Shas where those dinim of Kiddush and Havdalah and Kiddush Makom Suda and all kinds of things like that are discussed. So in the course of it, then the Gemara is talking about the dinim of Havdalah. So we know in the Brach of Havdalah, you say Amadim and Kodesh L'Chol and so forth, how many different Havdalahs, how many different distinctions in the world do you have to mention? So the Gemara brings various opinions about it. And Omer of Yechanan, B'nun Shok Doshim Oima Achas, a certain Tanner who was the son of holy people, as we're going to explain soon why he was called that, he would say only one. He would just say Amadim and Kodesh L'Chol and stop right there. the Nago Amlo Mesholish, people have the minhag to say three, which is we say the Hanav Ben Kodesh Lachol, Ben Oy Lachoshech, Ben Yisrael La'amin. Now Ben Yom Hashvi the Sheshes Me'amaisa doesn't count because that's only there in order to be Me'ein Chasima Samoch LaChasima. You have to have that before, in general, with any time you have a long bracha, meaning the kind that ends with a separate Baruch Atah Hashem, right before that ending, you have to have something similar to the theme of that bracha that you're about to say. That's called Me'ein Chasima Samoch LaChasima. We see that all over the place. You see, for example, in benching, and then you finish off Baruch Atah Hashem Azanas Hakol. And similarly, with any other bracha like that, you always have Me'ein Chasima Samoch LaChasima. So therefore, here we say Ben Yemashri, the Sheshes Me'amaisa, in order to be Me'ein Chasima Samoch LaChasima. So, but basically, you have three. So the Gemara says, Man Ninu Bnon Shokdoshim. Who is this Bnon Shokdoshim? That is Reb Menachem Bar Simon. Bamai Korali Bnon Shokdoshim. Why is he called by that title? Doi Stakov Tsurta de Zuza. He would never even look at the image on a coin. Now, the image on a coin, especially in those days, what the coins have, that have either images of Avodah Zarah or images of the emperor or something, which is practically the same thing, because half the emperors consider themselves gods too. But anyway, the point is, the Ikra Din, there's no problem looking at it, because it's something, you know, you look at it, Sam, and, you know, nobody pays much attention to it, nobody worships it or anything. But he was extra careful on himself, he wouldn't look at that. In fact, Tosfos brings from a Gemara in Moed Katan, in return for that, Midah Kenegan Midah, when he passed away, Hashem made that all of the images, all the statues that were in the town where he lived, all got flattened out. You had them all over the place, the statues of the emperor and statues of various other heroes and whatnot, and Hashem made a nest at that point, and all of them turned flat. They weren't engraved anymore in the design that they should be. And the Gemara explains, because the idea was that it said, or they said, Menashemayim, during his whole life, the Menachem was careful to never look at such images, even on a coin. It's not right that now, after he passed away, he should be forced, so to speak, to look at them as they're carrying his mitzvah through the streets. Therefore, the Eibishter made that all the images features disappeared. The point is, we're calling him Bnon Shel Kedoshim, Tosfos said. His father was also a Kaddish, but he himself had that extra level of Kedusha that he wouldn't even look at such images.
So the name Simon
comes from? The Pashtus, that's where the name Simon comes from, yeah. Well, Reb Menachem Reb Simoi, actually. Simoi isn't it? There is a name Simo, and you find a number of Amiroyim here and there, you find a number of Amiroyim here and there that have the name Simo. Yeah, the Pashtus has the name Simon, yeah. Bavashkas is like it's the Greek equivalent of Shimon, and it eventually became a name of its own, just like for example, Zalman came from Solomon, which is in turn from Shlomo, and other examples like that. Yeah. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ugola, Yudches Tishrei. So continuing, we started yesterday quoting from a sicha where the Rebbe talks about simcha space sheva, that we have that special simcha, and misha loyroh simcha space sheva, loyroh simcha miyamav, and here we don't even have the bis mikdash, but on the other hand, takanose takalosei, because we're already able to start with the full shturim of everybody on the first night, whereas in the bis mikdash they began only on the night of chalamoyed. So now the Rebbe continues, a yid could come and tain it. How can you tell me to be happy in simcha space sheva and increase from night to night? We're in Golos. So the answer will be that the whole idea is of Golos is that it should be Kein Yubah V'Chein Yifrit, like it was in Mitzrayim. We should be constantly increasing and growing bigger. So therefore, yes, a Yid can use that to dance and be happy by simple space or shade. Not only that, he goes and dances in the street. Again, unlike in the one in the Bismikdash, they danced, first of all, the regular people didn't dance for Chalau, only the Chassidim Anshei Maisa, but second of all, the dancing took place only in the Bismikdash. He was saying you go out into the common street, and you dance. And then, not only the street does not interfere with Simchas Beis HaSheva, just the opposite, you are poil on the street, that the street itself should dance, and everybody sees that it's a Chassidish street. So we'll continue tomorrow with another Beis Hashem, with another installment of this where the Rebbe talks about the importance of increasing constantly in Simchas Beis HaSheva. Continuing with Halachas of Shabbos. A person should not do malacha b'derech keva on Erev Shabbos from mincha k'tana u'lamayla. So in other words, we don't just mean any kind of malacha. A person can write something, a person can drive someplace or whatever, but to do a malacha b'derech keva to do like a work that's like his regular work, which is going to take a while, that he shouldn't do from Mincha Ktana and onward, which is 2.5 shores zmanis before Shabbos. The Alter Rebbe brings actually yesh oimrim that even the Isser is from Mincha Gdola, which would be half an hour after Chatzos. Yesh oimrim that's from Mincha Ktana. L'maisa, the Alter Rebbe says, in halacha, since it's only a matter of divrei sofrim, then if you make all, you don't lose out on the bracha. But derech ara is mutter. You would be allowed to do a brief incidental kind of malacha. And also, if it's l'tzorech Shabbos, then it's mutter even later than that. So, for example, to sew clothes for somebody else where you're getting paid for it would be an example of one of those kinds of things as also. But for example, if a person is poor and he's doing it in order to earn money for Shabbos, then he's allowed to the whole day, same as he'd be allowed on Chol HaMoed. Same thing, for example, to give haircuts to Jews is allowed all day, and that kind of thing, even a person can be paid for, because the haircutting is obviously being done with covered Shabbos. Another din in that connection, stores should be closed an hour before Shabbos. He refers to also something over here that he talks about if a person was traveling on the road on Erev Shabbos, at what point he has to stop so you have dinim that he talks about earlier. If a person has to spend Shabbos on the road or in a hotel or something, what he should do in terms of putting away his valuables and other things like that, so he's not carrying on Shabbos. Then another din, also about from also beginning from around Mincha Ktana. This one is actually from half an hour before Mincha Ktana, so nine shows manias into the day and onward. Then a person should not arrange a suda, even the kind of suda that he usually eats on weekdays. He shouldn't be doing from that point on Erev Shabbos. If it's an extra large suda and he's not even used to doing that on weekdays, then even if it's a sudas mitzvah, then it depends. Is it something that could be done on another day? Then you're also to do it Erev Shabbos anytime, even in the morning. But if it's something that is a timely thing, for example, a bris or a pinyan ben or whatever, then it would be mutter to have it on Erev Shabbos. Still, though, even then, it's better to do it in the morning. The Alter Rebbe phrases it, the mitzvah is to begin it v'chatchila before Shah Asiris, which would be, in other words, again, before nine Shoris Manias into the day. Anyway, well, you have to say the same thing, by the way, is Negea. We so often when Purim comes on Erev Shabbos, you have the same kind of thing. The Purim sort of needs to be eaten, it needs to be started earlier in the day. You also shouldn't eat too much, and certainly don't eat Achila Gasa, because you want to be able to eat the Shabbos meal with an appetite. That is, by the way, a topic that's actually discussed in this Perek Avot Pesachim that we're over here, although the Gemara doesn't really get in, whether the Ein Yaakov doesn't really get into much detail about it. Okay.